All right. Thank you, Bill, for that wonderful introduction. I'm going to talk about two kinds of progressivism, and I want to go way back to the start, the very beginning of it. And our guide this morning is going to be Irving Babbitt, the great new humanist and literary scholar at Harvard, whose book, Literature and the American College, is, I think, ought to be thought of as one of the founding documents, really, of the American conservative movement. People are not as familiar with it as they might be. In 1908, which is when Babbitt wrote this book, he superimposed upon the buzzing, blurring confusion of cultural controversies a tripartite framework of thought that's as illuminating now as it was then. Now, he starts out in a very Socratic fashion by trying to find out the definition for a word, in this case, the word humanism. And he discovers instead three profoundly antagonistic types of humanism. First, the scientific humanism, typified by Francis Bacon, the sentimental humanism, typified by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and then finally classical humanism, which is characterized by a succession of thinkers from Plato, Cicero, Burke, Emerson, John Henry Newman, and Babbitt himself. Now, Babbitt recommends reserving the word humanism for the third tradition, and instead prefers to use the word humanitarianism for the first two. Now, these two humanitarianisms are united by their early embrace of the idea of progress. Now, the recognition of a conflict between two versions of progress, one scientific and utilitarian, and one romantic and aesthetic, is a commonplace of modern thought, even a cliché. But Babbitt discerns beneath the superficial opposition between these two a deeper unholy alliance, which a perpetual war against the very survival of humane learning and classical learning, classical tradition. Babbitt grasped a fundamental truth that was first adumbrated by Plato in the Republic, that the most essential act of any culture is the education of its children. So a profound change in the character of a civilization is always going to express itself most clearly in who teaches what to whom and how. Everything else is really an epiphenomenon to that, in my view. Now, the liberal arts curriculum of America's colleges in the 19th century was the fruit of 2,500 years of development, beginning with the ancient schools of Plato and Aristotle, the Stoics, the Romans, and the early Middle Ages. The higher learning from late antiquity until the early 20th century was organized around the seven liberal arts, with philosophy and theology as the capstone. And the goal was an essentially ethical one, the formation of the virtues of self-control and prudence. The method, as you know, is the reading and emulation of a relatively fixed canon of literary classics, works that, in Babbitt's words, embody the seasoned and matured experience of man extending over a considerable time. As he goes on, by innumerable experiments, the world winnows out the more essential from the less essential. The ideal constitutions of the ancient and medieval worlds, from Plato's The Laws to Aristotle's Politics, Cicero, Polybius, Thomas Aquinas, was always a mixed constitution, one that synthesized elements from both democracy and aristocracy. The classical model of education reflected this concern for a balance, and early generations of Americans eagerly supported the liberal arts college with its classical curriculum as providing essential ballast to the leveling and libertine tendencies of a purely democratic society. The college was to form the country's natural aristocracy, as Jefferson put it. And Babbitt notes, the final test of a democracy, according to de Tocqueville, will be its power to produce and encourage the superior individual. However, this classical tradition faced increasing opposition throughout the 19th century, from utilitarian followers of Bentham, the scientistic disciples of Herbert Spencer, big government, big business, and German research university especially. Part one, the rise of scientific humanitarianism, Sir Francis Bacon. Babbitt identifies the work of Sir Francis Bacon, late 16th, early 17th century, as the fountainhead from which springs the first great modern challenge to classical synthesis, progress through scientific humanitarianism. Now, Bacon was not himself a scientist of any real note, but he was the first promoter, organizer, and propagandizer for science with a capital S as a perpetual institution. Bacon urged that the priorities of scientific research be revised, replacing the desire for a sort of quasi-spiritual contemplation of the essences of things with an unbridled quest for the acquisition of technical power over nature. Bacon urged that through systematic experimentation, nature be put to the rack and forced to reveal its secrets, something he knew a little about, I guess. He recommended that any thought about the final ends or purposes of natural things, teleology, be relegated to theology. Instead, man should impose their wills upon the raw material of nature by better understanding the propensities of its parts. Bacon served as Lord Chancellor under James I, but was forced out of office and convicted of bribery. Nonetheless, he remained influential, inspiring the creation of the Royal Society. As Babbitt notes, Thomas Babington Macaulay, the British Whig historian in the 19th century, spends the first half of his biography of Bacon on how mean a man Bacon was, and the second half on how glorious the Baconian idea of progress is. Babbitt argues that the moral vacuum within Bacon has exactly the same source as his ideas. As Babbitt puts it, by seeking to gain dominion over things, he lost dominion over himself. Bacon's zeal for single-minded pursuit of technical prowess initiated what Weber has called the disenchantment of the world, and ultimately the disenchantment of man himself. Once teleology is kicked out of the domain of human reason and restricted to that of faith, the scientific mind can no longer distinguish between those healthy inclinations that are proper to human nature and diseased or disordered inputs. Reason became, as David Hume put it, the slave of the passions, an instrument for merely scratching whatever itches. As a consequence, the goal of education was reduced to the acquisition of scientifically grounded technique, with the ethical dimension left to church, home, ironically enough, at one point to athletics. In fact, the dormitory was invented as an instrument of moral uplift, believe it or not. Babbitt accurately reflects the infection of the humanities themselves by physics envy, something I'm very familiar with. Scientism and over-specialization have taken hold within the study of literature and history. As Babbitt puts it, man himself and the products of his spirit, language, and literature are treated as not having a law of their own, but as things subject to the same methods that have won for science such triumphs over phenomenal nature. Babbitt insisted that comparative and historical studies must be subordinated to humane standards and reinforced by a set of absolute values. By contrast, the scientific historian subjects man to the law for thing, as he puts it. Ironically, the triumph of naturalism in human studies ends up denaturing man, neglecting the peculiar law for man. In place of the pursuit of wisdom and the elucidation of meaning, the modern scientists use quantitative methods to study human behavior, as though human beings were nothing more than sacks of chemicals endlessly seeking equilibrium. And the modern humanist studies texts as mere secretions of the nervous system, a Darwinian struggle for power. With remarkable foresight, Babbitt, writing in 1908, argues that the German educational model, which was really influenced by Bacon, demonstrates, quote, that it's easier to be scientific or erudite or enthusiastic than to be civilized. Babbitt also notes that with Bacon, we see the appearance of a libido sciendi, an unbridled lust for encyclopedic knowledge. The universal knowledge sought by Bacon and his disciples exceeds the capacities of any individual or any single generation. It's instead an infinite, unbounded aspiration to be carried out by a vast, immortal body of men, science, capital S, now the name for a concrete social institution and no longer just the abstract word for knowledge. The educational counterpart of this limitless progress is, in Weber's terms again, science or Wissenschaft as a vocation. The lifelong devotion of the specialist to the contribution of some original research to an ever-growing treasury of knowledge. From this perspective, general education is merely a preamble to the inevitable specialization of the true intellectual, designed merely to provide the would-be specialist with those few tools of language, logic, and mathematics that are of general use. Part two, sentimental humanitarianism, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The second fountainhead of modernity erupts from the works of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the Swiss philosopher and essayist, whose influence simply cannot be overestimated. Babbitt quotes Jules Lemaître as having a feeling of sacred horror at the extent of that influence. As the father of modern romanticism, Rousseau gives at first glance the impression of being the polar opposite of the pragmatic, rational, and scientific Bacon. Indeed, there are, of course, many instances of conflict between the two, tensions between Victorian industrialists and arts and crafts movement, or between Defense Department technocrats and folk singing hippies over the Vietnam War. Nonetheless, the superficial tensions between these two cultures of scientific pragmatism and romantic individualism merely disguise the more fundamental affinities. Both are united in their rejection of the teleologically ordered cosmos of the classical tradition, with its finite and universal goal of happiness through self-restraint, eudaimonia. In its place, the moderns substitute the unbounded pursuit of infinite progress. Both Bacon and Rousseau were men, as Babbitt puts it, of weak and in many respects contemptible character. Rousseau consigned each of his five babies to the public creche and certain death over the desperate protests of his common-law wife. Babbitt insists that we cannot ignore these biographical facts of these men when evaluating the philosophical movements they gave rise to, since the immorality of the two founders is perfectly reflected in the amoralism of their philosophies. Now, Babbitt himself was writing near the end of the term of Harvard president Charles William Eliot, who had been president from 1869 to 1909. Eliot revolutionized higher education, not only at Harvard, but throughout America, by replacing the set curriculum with the elective system. Babbitt quotes Eliot, expressing this Rousseauist idea. This is now Eliot. "A well-instructed youth of 18 can select for himself a better course of study than any college faculty or any wise man. Every youth of 18 is an infinitely complex organization, the duplicate of which never will or never does exist." As Babbitt sardonically comments, "The wisdom of all the ages is to be nothing as compared with the inclinations of a sophomore." Babbitt calls Rousseau a moral impressionist, who, like the ancient sophists, sought to rest virtue in the shifting quicksands of sensibility. In the classical tradition founded by Socrates and dominant in the Western world until the 18th century, ethical wisdom is a form of knowledge grounded in exercise of reasoning intelligence. Through the proper understanding of our natural inner telos, the practical intellect is able to judge and weigh the various and conflicting desires. Whereas, in contrast, the moral sentimentalist, like Rousseau, sees moral principle as merely as the superstitious reification of human feeling, especially the feeling of pity and compassion. Ethics thus lies forever beyond the bounds of rationality and scientific understanding. It's a realm of values, not of facts. As Babbitt puts it, Rousseau confounds the law for man with his own temperament. Eliot's elective system is the perfect embodiment of Rousseau's philosophy, in which the student is compelled to be free by being denied the opportunity to undertake a coherent and well-ordered course of study. As Babbitt notes, Plato in the Republic already described the Rousseauian, described Rousseau prophetically in his depiction of the democratic personality. "A perfect equality rules the democratic soul. Each impulse and whim claims the equal right to the individual's time and energies." Translated into education, the result is what Babbitt calls the democracy of studies. The modern university is a mere cafeteria of courses. Plato again predicted this outcome in the Laws, that we would see, quote, "encyclopedic smattering and miscellaneous experiment," unquote. As Babbitt observes, a bachelor's degree now merely means, quote, "that a man has expended a certain number of units of intellectual energy on a list of elective studies that range from boiler making to Bulgarian, a question of intellectual ohms and amperes and volts." Although the elective system promised greater autonomy to the student, in practice it has become the worst kind of tyranny. If there are no courses that the students are required to take, then there are no courses that professors are required to teach. Consequently, it's the individual professors, not the students, who decide what courses shall be offered. And both training and self-interest drive professors to narrow courses that transmit to captive audiences the result of the professor's own specialized research. In place of a spacious vision of a Grand Canyon in the classical curriculum, the elective system simply drops the individual down a succession of widely scattered oil wells. Section 3, the common ground of modernity. The examination of the new college curriculum brings to light the underlying commonality of the sentimental and the scientific progressivism, because both forward a course of studies that privileges the quantity of information over any selection based on quality. Both conceive of a college as an engine of social progress, ignoring the vitally important task of the assimilation and perpetuation of culture. Both deny the existence of a natural end or telos of man, the conception of a finite and balanced fulfillment of human nature, rationally intelligible and fixed. Both reduce the scope of knowledge to what can be secured by the methods of physical science, with the capacity to control and manipulate as the acid test. And both hold the wisdom of the past in contempt, replacing piety towards our forebears with a chronological narcissism and a naive faith in the fusion of scientific technique with the sentiment of humanity. Humanitarians conceive of higher education as encompassing just two tasks: the production and distribution of knowledge. They ignore the need for rational reflection. Babbitt, echoing Montaigne, insisted that the ambition of teachers must be not simply to distribute knowledge, not to lodge it with their students, but to, quote, marry it to them and make it part of their minds, their very minds and souls. This process of reflection and assimilation requires three things that are denied to today's students. Teachers who've been selected on the basis of their breadth and of learning and their maturity of thinking, the study of profound texts that have stood the test of time, and the leisure of reflecting together on the same subjects over a period of years, not just of weeks. To quote Babbitt again, "the fact that men once read the same books at college was no slight bond of fellowship," unquote. According to Babbitt, we run the risk of, quote, "having our minds buried beneath a dead weight of information, which we have no energy, no power of reflection to put to our own uses and to convert into vital nutriment. By hollowing out the humanities, depriving them of their serious moral purpose, humanitarian philosophy of progress has driven students from liberal learning to an increasingly narrow vocational orientation. Now, one thing that Babbitt did not anticipate was the rise of political correctness in the academy, but his analysis does provide us the grounds for seeing why that was inevitable. Nature abhors a vacuum. The emptying from the curriculum of the high moral purpose of character formation and the acquisition of wisdom created a chasm into which 1,000 ideological demons have swarmed. The crises and the disasters of the last century have made the myth of inevitable progress lose its credibility. The selfless pursuit of humanitarian aims can persist only if the myth is somehow revived through an allegiance to a political ideology that promises millenarian transformation. And this is the reason for the rise of political correctness within the academy. A new kind of Gnosticism has taken hold, just as Eric Bogelman predicted it would. Gnostics transfer the hope for infinite value of salvation from the next world to the future of this one. Instead, scientific technique and philanthropic enthusiasm synthesized by a seductively comprehensive political doctrine promised to distribute an infinite good to everyone in the near future if we will only swear allegiance to the harbingers of revolution. Willing participation in this political program has become the most stringent and essential of all credentials in academia. The one place in the world in which Marxism still thrives is in the literature and social science colleges of America. The grip of political correctness, however, extends throughout the system, from elite universities to community colleges and throughout the various disciplines. Now, these pedantic revolutionaries are certainly doomed to failure. No parsing of syntax or reimagining of popular literature, no critique of television sitcoms will ever overthrow the established order. However, the tactical folly of these Ches and Fidels of the classroom is little comfort when we take into account the huge opportunity cost that they extract. Students who spend their college years drilled in the catechisms of the left lose forever the chance to enrich their imagination, inform their consciences, and stimulate their powers of reflection through reading together the great works of our tradition under the tutelage of the heirs of that tradition. A university can encompass the study of many cultures, but it can perpetuate only one. And the devotees of political correctness ensure that it perpetuates absolutely nothing. Now, Babbitt did note the tendency of academic ideologues to set up an imaginary dualism in society. And he anticipated Solzhenitsyn's famous aphorism about the line between good and evil passing through the human heart. Okay, for reason of time, let me skip ahead to section 5, reviving the classical tradition. As Dr. Johnson says to Boswell, "My dear friend, clear your mind of Kant." Dr. Johnson's advice is indispensable. Any meaningful reform of higher education demands that we clear away the cant of progress, whether scientific or philanthropic. Now, I'm actually optimistic. I think the upward spiral of costs and the downward spiral of quality are pushing the system to a critical point, at which large numbers of intelligent young people will simply become university refuseniks. Marvelous texts and lectures are now available for free online, in academic open source, like in iTunes, for example. Social media and teleconferencing make possible the spontaneous formation of international communities of scholarly amateurs in the best and original sense of the word, and through which the heritage of the West can find an outlet. All that is needed is for the remaining scholars of the true Republic of Letters, those faithful thousands who haven't bowed the knee to Baal, to join together and to add some formal standards of quality and selectivity to the process. Let me just close by mentioning that I've been involved with the Great Books program at UT, I've become aware of the fact that there are dozens, now I think I'm up to about 30 or actually nearly 40 small colleges and programs that are burgeoning around the nation, that are emerging, that either have a Great Books curriculum or even better, a classical curriculum that's heavily dependent on Latin and Greek. And so there are hopeful signs. I think what we need to do is to use this new technology, byproduct, of course, of Bacon, ironically, to create a new sort of university structure, a new Oxford that can unite these colleges, enable them to have more of a presence and more of a reputation that can attract students. I'll put there then. Thanks.